Okay, this is the fourth class of How We Got Here. And today we're going to make the transition from what I call the seeds of how we got into the seeds of Jewish history to the foundation of Jewish history. We started off, we established right in the beginning, the Jewish history has destiny, and that starts all the way with the way the world was created. We spoke about Avram, and we did two classes on this, how Avram discovers and proclaims to the world that there is one invisible, all-powerful God. Yitzchak, we spoke about last week, how he teaches introspection, the idea of the digging of the wells. We also spoke about how both Avram and Yitzchak fathered people who would eventually become those who would like to get rid of the Jewish people because the beginnings of materialism versus spirituality. And I just want to add one point to which I don't know if I made it last week or not, just on this point. Why, when it came to, okay, they were brothers, Yitzchak and Shmuel were brothers, they were actually half-brothers. But the point that I want to emphasize is about Yaakov and Esav being twins. Why did they have to be twins specifically? Materialism and spirituality are very closely related. The only way the world has a purpose is when the spirituality that is hidden within materialism is elevated by that which is overtly spiritual. So since the connection is so intrinsic, this is why it comes up with the idea of twins. Okay. All right, back to our subject. Yaakov, he begets the 12 tribes. All of the children are righteous. So this is really the end of this era of sowing the seeds, because he's now come to the point where this is going to be the Jewish people. 12 children. And we're not going to go into the details of the wives and so on, because it doesn't really, not so necessary to get into that now. So we're going to skip some things and emphasize certain things.
Is this where we become Jewish?
It's coming up today.
I want to get to the terminology and understand that transition.
Okay.
Between Hebrews, Israelites, and Jews.
We are going to get there today. All right.
Did you miss that? That we were on the floor?
Well, all right. Because we're into all of it, and when are we getting there? Yeah. So these are the children of Yaakov, or Yisroel, the story of the wrestling with the angel. His name is called Yisrael. I didn't go into that into detail because that's not so important for us right now. But since you mentioned it, his name is Yaakov. But as he's approaching Esav, so at night he wrestles with the angel, and then in the morning he doesn't want to let the angel go. The angel has to go. He says, okay, you give me a blessing. I give you a blessing. Your name is no longer Yaakov. It is Yisrael. Did I mention this last week at all? No. What is the meaning of Yaakov? The name Yaakov is Yud, and then Akev. Akev means a heel. The heel is the bottom. And the Yud, which is the smallest letter, represents that intellectual inspiration when an idea falls into our head. This is a whole subject unto itself in Kabbalah. In God's name, the first letter is Yud. That's what it represents. It represents the intellectual inspiration and then expansion and so on. Akev, the heel, is the bottom. And the purpose is, of course, to take the godly inspiration and reach it all the way down to the lowest levels of the world here. So that's in the name Yaakov. And the name Yisroel, which is made up of the word Sariso, which means you accomplished, that you fought with a godly angel and with people and you accomplished. So aside from the idea of a heel, is where you take your marching orders and you do them. That's also represented by the heel. And you do it right. But when you accomplish, that's when you have the enthusiasm that goes along with it. So that's already Yisrael, which is why both names are used, even though we're called the children of Israel. The children of Israel, these are the 12 tribes, back to where we are. They are the children of Yisrael, the sons of Yaakov. Now, what is the transition into the beginning or the foundation of Jewish history? Jewish history operates in a spiral, in an upward spiral, which means that things repeat themselves, but each time that it repeats themselves, it becomes more profound. In the lives of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, we had a foretelling of what's going to be. For example, the slavery in Egypt God told Avram specifically what it's going to be. Here we have the story of Joseph or Yosef and his brothers, which I'll go through with some detail to make some points, but this is really the story that brought the Jewish people, and it's really the Israelites actually, but we'll talk about that soon, down to the land of Egypt, which is where it all begins. And peoplehood begins there, and we'll explain that now. So what was the story with Yosef? Yosef has two dreams, which in effect, those dreams where it's the stars bowing down to him in the second dream, in the first dream, that the brothers are all cutting down sheaves and they bow down to him. So he has these dreams which seem to imply that he's going to have supremacy over the brothers. They don't like it. They decide they're going to kill him. They don't. They throw him into a pit. Now the truth of the matter is, why would they kill him just over a dream? So that really is a subject, and it's not for today because it's not integral to our discussion. Suffice to say that every single point is exhaustively explained and can be explained to complete satisfaction. In any event, he's in the pit, and then they sell him to some people in a caravan that are going down to Egypt. And that's how he gets taken down to Egypt. When he's in Egypt,
and they tell his father he's dead.
They tell his father that he's dead. In Egypt, first he works, he's a servant. Then he gets accused of some incident, and he gets thrown into a jail cell. And he's there for a number of years, and then through dreams, he gets extracted from the jail and is appointed as the second to the king, the viceroy of Egypt. What is important here is the distinction between, one of the important things is the distinction between Yosef and the rest of his brothers, who, as shepherds, like Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, our forefathers, it is easy to serve God when you're out there in the field and you're watching sheep. Because what are the distractions? But when you become a slave, you've been in prison, so you've been all the way at the bottom of the totem pole and all the way at the top. So all of the tests of oppression and of affluence and power are all there. And you can remain righteous. Now that is something. And that's really where the supremacy of Yosef lies in, because he is the, that's what I'm looking for, he is the prototype for the Jewish people, that we are going to be in these situations. We're going to be certainly oppressed. And in certain fields and certain endeavors, we rise to the top, whether it's Alan Greenspan or his successor, who's also Jewish, or all other Jewish people, or Einstein, you name it, the oppression we don't even have to speak about. That this is the prototype that we still maintain or endeavor to maintain our righteousness throughout. It turns out that why is he extricated from the jail cell? Because he interprets the dream of the Pharaoh that there's going to be years of plenty and years of hunger. And he advises them to store food for the years of hunger. The whole region has a famine, and this famine affects the Israel as well, which is right next door. And Yaakov sends his sons down to get food. Eventually they meet up with Yosef. It's a whole story. At the very end, when they discover that the person who's in charge of all of Egypt, effectively, outside of the Pharaoh, is their own brother, so of course they remember the dreams, and of course they have nothing but remorse. And Yosef says to them, you should not worry, this is God's plan. God planned it all along. This point that Yosef says at the very end is the reason that I went into the details of the story, because we could first say, well, this is you sibling rivalry, and I mean, what's in this story? This story indicates, first of all, everything that happens is a divine plan, and I'm going to talk about that for a moment soon, which may seem to contradict the freedom of choice, which it doesn't. But one other thing. The view of history, and it is my personal belief that this is not just a Jewish view, but an accurate view of history, is not about, quote, historical forces and monumentous things necessarily. History is made up of the lives of individual people. And it's individual people that make differences happen. There's a tremendous part of the autobiography of Ronald Reagan in which he described his meeting with Gorbachev. Now, I'll have you know, and he talks about it in the book, that Reagan was not the first one to try and bring down the Iron Curtain and bring some normalcy to the world. Several of his predecessors did as well, but they just didn't succeed, so it never made the news. Even in the life of Reagan, there were a number of presidents of the Soviet Union. Are they presidents or prime minister? Presidents, I think, right? Whatever.
Presidents,
probably. Okay. Presidents, okay. There were a number of them who died in the middle, if you remember. Finally, there's this summit with Gorbachev. And he goes on to this, in his whole story, he shows how he himself come from humble beginnings. And all he wanted to be was a radio announcer, and the whole story. He says to Gorbachev, "You and I are from humble beginnings," which was true in both cases. Gorbachev is a descendant of Cossacks, but whatever his life story is, to the extent that it's mentioned there. And I read up on that myself as well. "You and I from humble beginnings, we are here together. We can really make a change in this world." And they did. Gorbachev admitted to Herman Bronova, a Soviet scientist who became a Lubavitcher when it was still underground yet. He is presently literally a world-class scientist in his field, which has to do with solar energy and who knows what. And he's been on contract with the U.S. government, I don't know, for some 40 years, I don't know, forever. But at any rate, so he told Gorbachev that when Gorbachev told him, when he was initially elected, he planned to be more of a hardliner than his predecessors. Which is very interesting. The reason that I'm bringing all this is because here you have individual lives, and what happened in their life has made a difference in the world. And really, I think this is the way that we need to view history, and I think that's one of the messages on a very plain level, without getting too mystical about it, why in the Torah certain episodes of individuals are elaborated upon. We, in our life, can also have impact. I'm just going to tell a personal story, which it happened. I was once at a Shiva house a number of years ago, and a fellow came over to me, and he said, "Do you remember me?" I said, "I do, I remember your face, and I have hard times with names." And he said, "We had a discussion about this and this." I said, "Do you remember?" I said, "I remember some of it," which I did. He told me, "I took your advice, and because of it, I got involved in the Talmud Torah board, and I did this, and I changed jobs, da 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 da." You know, God help me, I was, at my age now, I look at myself, I was quite young when I met him, because I was years prior, and was I such a big chochem that I could say who knows what that a person, the Almighty put words in someone's mouth. You know, it's like they say when Bilam, he had his donkeys, right? God opened the donkey's mouth and it spoke. So sometimes, you know, you're the donkey, God opens up your mouth and you speak. But you see, there's a message here, because Jewish people believe this. Jewish people believe that individual actions make a difference. Some people say, what difference does it make to God if I would do something just like this and like this? Well, first of all, as an aside, that is creating God in man's image. If God were to think like man, then maybe small things are inconsiderate. But if God is an infinite God, then what do you mean? You view the world this way, so you think this is nothing. Therefore, he thinks like you. I mean, it's illogical. But besides all of that, Yiddishkeit teaches us that every little thing does make a difference. And just in the form of history, this is what we can see in this story, because it brought the Jewish people down to Egypt, which eventuated in the Exodus and with the peoplehood of the Jewish people.
Rabbi, can I ask a question? I agree with you, but it seems to me that we're saying two contradictory things. We're saying that individual people can make a difference,
yes,
and that the story shows it. But just before, we said Joseph tells his brothers, this was God's plan all along.
Right, right.
So that's very in good. Your face. Or
right. So we want to get that very soon. That's one of the things that I need to get to.
Okay.
So I'm just going to go a little further ahead, then I'm going to back up,
yes,
and I plan to remember to back up all other things in the right order. Eventually, the brothers bring their father down, and that's where they settle in Egypt, and he has the last 10 years of his life. They do well there. They're in Goshen, and they're in the best place in the land of Egypt. Once all the brothers die, then the slavery begins. slavery, which was foretold by God to Abraham. And now we're going to back up and make some points here. Destiny and freedom of choice, and also the point that you mentioned, which will be incorporated. Freedom of choice, first of all, only applies in the arena of right and wrong. Now, it's going to sound like it's a digression. Really, it's not, because if we don't explain this now, then there is a conflict with the way we view all of history. Because if it's all destiny, then what's the point? It's going to happen anyway. And the Almighty says very clearly, I place before you a choice between good and bad, life and death. You should choose life. So it is this. Choice is only in the arena of right and wrong. What is right and wrong? This is an enormous question. Because for many philosophers, for the longest time until today, good and bad depends on human understanding. If we accept that, and I'm going to go all the way because I don't think it's a whole long philosophical discussion, we could. If it's based on human understanding, then who says Hitler was wrong? You say, he says the opposite. You follow the majority, he got elected by a majority. Moral relativism, which is really a foundational ideology of the halls of academia today and always has been, that is the flaw with it. In other words, morality is relative. As long as morality is relative, then maybe partial birth abortions not only is okay, maybe it should be mandatory sometimes, just laws, and on it goes. And there's no end. The only way right and wrong can be determined without influence of the world is by someone or something that is not subject to the influences of the world. The only one I know is not subject to the influences of the world is the Almighty. The Almighty says this is right, this is wrong. As we said way at the outset, that the population control used to be, you don't like the baby, you kill it, you leave it outside, so the weather will take care of it, the wild animals. And this happened in every ancient civilization except for the Jewish people. God says, killing is wrong. That was, believe it or not, that's actually, it's a novel idea. And in some places, it's literary. I mean, until recently, we said this before, the only might made right. Alexander the Great, he's great because he had the might to conquer so much of the world. Okay, we look at it, we say it's atrocious. The Almighty, all the way back in the beginning, he said, killing is wrong, incest is wrong, homosexuality is wrong, all these ideas are revolutionary ideas. God said this is wrong. In the arena of what God says is right or wrong, those are the only places where choice applies. So let's take a practical example. You buy a car. You think you like this car because it's an import, and it has this color, and it has these and these features, and so on. That's incorrect. That is what God has put into motion, that you should choose the car that he wants. You should choose, right? The evidence. God said that somebody gets into an accident, and as a result, this car is totaled. The other one is hardly totaled. This one gets hurt, this one doesn't. They're all caused by one and the other. Now, let's take the same situation of buying a car with freedom of choice. A person decides to steal a car, whether to steal the car literally, or to write a fraudulent check, or use somebody else's credit card, or any of these things. That's where freedom of choice comes in, right and wrong. Now, there's another element which you have to throw in, and this will answer your point. God has many ways of getting things done. Just like you want to type something on the screen. You have characters on the screen. How did they get there? Well, either they were typed in, maybe they were imported, maybe there was a macro, which means a series of executed commands, right? You press one button, the whole series of commands. There could be a million ways. So God can make things happen in many, many ways. And God wants to make a person have a certain, for example, level of livelihood. He can either make him earn lots of money, but then there'll be a lot of leakage through insurance, through damage to the house, through lawsuits, or all sorts of things.
Well, the person can have ultimately the same lifestyle. With none of those, he'll earn less. But the lifestyle will be the same. There's many ways of making things happen. Matter of fact, I'd like to mention a point that's even deeper than that. With this story, there's a head librarian of the Rebbe's library in 770, is somebody called Rabbi Baruch Levin, and he is truly, in my opinion, one of the great scholars of the world today, although he's unknown, he's just sitting there in the library, but he's just brilliant, because great scholars who've met up with him and spoken with him and learning, see, this is really somebody, wow. And Lubavitch, Siddhis, based on Siddhis, we de-emphasize the honor and all of those things. Yiddish in general, but Siddhis in particular. At any rate, this story happened with him. One Friday night, he's walking home from shul, and in Crown Heights, you have Jews who are white, you have blacks. And many of those blacks live a life that is similar to the graffiti that they would leave all over the place. Okay. So a little kid, maybe 10 years old, comes over to him with a gun. Give me your money. It's Friday night, no money. So he basically, I don't know, throws him down to the floor or beats him up. Or I don't know what. The guy's got a gun, right? So he's got to defend himself. So he figured he'd, okay. And he goes home. Comes home. And his wife looks at him and she becomes white. The way his beard grew then, it's first like a goatee naturally, that came from. And she said, "What's all this blood caked up in your beard?" He said, "Really?" What happened was that this little boy actually shot, and the bullet hit his chin. He didn't even realize it. Now I want you to think for a minute. A half an inch up, it would go straight into the brain. And below it going to his neck. That would have been it. So here is freedom of choice. The nations of the world are given to the seven Noahide laws. One of them is not to murder. So here's a little kid. In that arena, he chooses to kill somebody. The Almighty doesn't let the deed be done, even though the choice is executed. Right? In other words, even the fact that somebody's choice to do right or wrong, whether it happens or not, is also divine providence. A person may try and plan for a month with his buddies to rob a bank, and he keeps driving around in a stolen car. And for some reason, because the gas station next door, they've got some false alarm, so there's police there. They can't do it. And then their window of time, for whatever reason, is over. Finished. It didn't happen, right? So the Almighty has to allow the choice to happen as well. So that's where we get to the coexistence, if I may say, of this conflict. All right. So now, back to the point. Even one person can make a difference because the Almighty gives us the ability, by doing the right things, to elect, therefore, to be the vehicle for the good, or by doing the wrong things to elect to be the vehicle for the bad. Ultimately, no matter what happens, it's by divine providence. This point can be elaborated on greatly, but for our purposes, we really should move on. With the coming of Yosef, of Joseph, down to Egypt, and the rest of his brothers and his family, begins what I will call the foundation of the Jewish people. Because the foundation is life in Egypt, then the exodus of Egypt, in the desert, and into the promised land. And after that foundation, we go into the rest of Jewish history. At least that's the way I divide it. So, now, the Pharaoh, he decides, whatever his reasons are, that he's going to oppress the Jewish people, and how he actually takes a whole great number of people and convinces them to get into slavery, a whole story. So that's the pace of. Totally.
Right.
It's been foretold to Avram. So this begs the question, why? Why did it have to be? From when Isaac first went down to Egypt, that begins a calculation of 400 years. But the actual servitude in Egypt, 210 years. Why? Because this establishes many things. Let's just briefly mention some of the events leading up to the Exodus itself, and then mention why this is had to happen and why this had to be the foundation. So eventually there is born a child, Moses. We're told the details of how he was born. There was a decree, all the children should be killed, and therefore his mother hides him, and eventually he gets raised actually in the home of the Pharaoh himself by Pharaoh's daughter, Basia. Basia, that's her name. The sages tell us that when Moses was born, the house was filled with light. And we're told a lot of details about his initial birth. Then it simply says he grew up, and then he went out to see how the people are doing. Why are we told about his birth? Because again, this is all planned by the Almighty. This is the way it's to be. Eventually, Moses has to flee from Egypt, and he goes to a place called Midian, where he meets by a well the daughters of Yisroel. He eventually marries a woman, Sapphira. When he's there, he also works as a shepherd. And this story is told because he's running after a single sheep who's run away from the flock. Instead of saying, well, so he runs and he's going to carry the sheep back because the sheep's tired. And God meets him at the burning bush, where there's a bush, a thorn bush, and it's burning, it's not consumed. God speaks to him, I want you to speak to the Pharaoh thus and thus, and you're going to take the Jewish people out. Moses, he comes to the Pharaoh. I'm sorry, so we're told all the details of his childhood because, again, this is something special that God has planted. And also, we're told the story about the sheep because even before he became a leader, he showed how his one little sheep, and he's caring for the little sheep. That's the proper leader, right? Unlike others, Stalin, the Machshemoy, said, if you want to make an omelette, you have to break eggs, you have to crack eggs. And who did I hear repeat that? It's his name, Arafat, right? Mm-hmm. When the Russians go to war, they have so many people. They could just feed people into the war machine so they get chewed up and spat out the other end, and so what? Nobody could win Russia, it's too big, we got too many people, right? That kind of thing. Versus, in Yiddishkeit, if you're a leader, then you pay attention to every single individual. Okay, so he's the leader. And he performs these miracles in front of the Pharaoh. There are the 10 plagues. And the last of the 10 plagues, which is the killing of the firstborn, and God gives the Jewish people instruction how to make the Paschal offering. They've got to take this lamb. And at exactly the right time, at midnight, the firstborns all die. Then in the morning, the Jewish people all leave. And in the interim, they go to their neighbors, the non-Jews, who give them tremendous wealth. They leave with great wealth, exactly as promised to our forefather Abraham. Okay, now, why did all of this have to be? We go back to what we said last week about the struggle between materialism and spirituality. Here is the foundation. You're going to be in a place that is not your own, and you're going to be tested. Now, you can choose to struggle for spiritual, for survival by either struggling to be holy. If you don't, you'll have a different kind of a struggle. What am I talking about? What happened was that at first, Paro came along with this patriotic drive, this is the word we would use today, of rebuilding certain cities that were destroyed. The Jewish people, of course, they have to be more patriotic than the non-Jews, which is a sickness that we have forever. And the reason that I emphasize this point is I, in the light of history, will never understand Jewish patriotism. Because every single country has betrayed us. Every single one of them. We anyway contribute far more than anybody else. So as far as being contributors, there's no contest. But this business of patriotism, I just can't stomach it. But at any rate, the Jewish people, they get sucked into this patriotic drive. And eventually, Pharaoh says, I'm not going to pay you back. And they end up still doing the work. And you know how sometimes kids will get... On and on, they'll push more and more and more. And then you're stuck. There's no going back, which is what happened here. When this first happened, there was the tribe of Levi. The tribe of Levi, what patriotic tribe? We got to study God's wisdom. We're not going anywhere. So the first day they didn't go. So for the entire duration of the slavery, the tribe of Levi was not involved in the slavery, which is why Moses from that tribe was not involved in the slavery. You see, what happened is the test was as follows. You're going to be in a situation where you're going to be lured away from spirituality. If you get sucked into it, then you will be reminded in a harsh way that you are God's people. If you don't, you'll remind yourself you're God's people. It won't be harsh, because you'll be harsh on yourself to remember that you're God's people. And that's exactly what happened with the tribe of Levi. They obviously made the better choice than the rest of the people did not. And this, we can already hear how this is such foretelling of what the future of the Jewish people is going to be. That if we don't remember that we are Jews, and we try to blend into the scene, the non-Jews are going to come and slap us on the side of the face and remind us that we're Jews. Not only in recent history, but all the way back. This goes all the way back. And again, we have to remember that accomplishment is earned. So there is no easy street. There is no easy street. Easy street is when a person is dead, that's the easy street. But accomplishment is a struggle. So that's the first foundation of why there had to be slavery to begin with. And here when he's promising Abraham, back then before Abraham even had any children, they promised him that you're going to have a great people and this is what's going to be. That's why, because this is about purpose. And I'd like to interject a particular story, because I think it's quite instructive. There is a book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. It's not called Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. When Bad Things Happen to Good People by Harold Kushner. I read most of the book. Some pieces I missed out. I listened to the book on tape as he read it. I listened to him speak, the subject of his book, in Fort Worth, Texas. And there was a long line of people to get his book signed. I waited till the very end because I want to have a talk with him, not just say hello, goodbye. And I asked him this question. I said, in your book, and he says many things which can make you feel good. Doesn't mean it's theologically right. I believe they're theologically wrong, heretical as a matter of fact.
Yeah, you're not the first rabbi who I've heard say that.
In effect, the thesis of the book is that God cannot stop the evil that happens. God forbid to say so. That's what he says. And people are around to be God's messengers to do good in spite of the evil that is out of control. That's the thesis of the book. So I said to him, I asked him rather, I said, if that's the case, how can that be a comfort? How can that give meaning as to why bad things happen? You didn't really answer the question. All you're saying is, bad things happen, that's it, too bad. Now, I must say, he wrote this book because he had a son with a terrible disease of progeria that's rapid aging. That doesn't, you see, when you read that, I mention this point because when you read it, you kind of get sucked into the, that he has the right to speak on a subject. That doesn't make him intellectually correct. Okay, even though he and his family suffered on account of it. So, I said, you haven't answered the question. As a matter of fact, interestingly, somebody before this happened, during question and answer period, somebody asked, don't we recite on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur in the prayer, on the Sanatekev, a very solemn prayer, and that on Yom Kippur, and Rosh Hashanah it's written, in Yom Kippur it is sealed, who will live, who will die, who by fire, who by water, all of that. He said, in my synagogue we go through that piece very quickly. That's what he said. In front of hundreds of people. I'm just telling you a fact.
What was your point on that? What was he trying to...
What he's trying to say is that he doesn't agree with that piece of liturgy, so they just rush through it. Okay? Anyway, he says, so I asked him this question, but you haven't really answered the question. You haven't ascribed any meaning. He said, you'll notice that the title of my book is not Why Bad Things, it's When Bad Things Happen to Good People. He said, 2 weeks ago, there was a woman in a wheelchair who asked me the same question with different words. She said, I'm in such agony and such suffering. So
So what's the meaning behind it all? If I knew, she said, if I knew there was meaning, it would be easier to tolerate. He said to me, so I said to her, in that case, my book is not for you. Isn't that something?
So who's this book for? Why did you write
that? The book is
why bad things happen to good people. This is when...
No, it's the same
book. It's the same book. People misquote the title. I know it's the same book. It's by Harold Kushner. Yes, I'm telling you. The book is written in a way, he's a talented writer, you can feel quite good after it. Okay? When you describe, for example, how people help other people, it's very warm and fuzzy, I shouldn't say that, for that kind of subject. But it's a warm book. But it doesn't make it make sense, even by his own admission, no meaning, right? So getting back to the Exodus of Egypt, right from the start, we are given a very clear portrayal of the model of Jewish life, and that is struggle to bring spirituality into this materialistic world, and if you don't struggle, the struggle will come to you. And that makes it meaningful, because if it's easy, then there's no purpose, and life is without meaning. Jewish people cannot live without meaning. It's the reason I believe that in every movement ever, Jewish people have always been in the forefront, at least those that have altered the world. Jews have always been in the forefront, for better or worse, because we are purpose-seeking people more than other people. People in general are, but Jews more than that. Then there's another thing. With the Jewish people in Egypt, there was a planned change in God's approach to the Jewish people. And here is where I'm going to answer your question, Jews, Israelites, how to make sense of it all. So I'm going to make a digression and work backwards now. 12 tribes, we know there were 12 tribes. Let's move forward from where we are in the desert, I'm sorry, in Egypt, to where the Jewish people are in Israel. And there's 12 tribes living there, but essentially they're split. There's a northern kingdom of 10 tribes, and there's two tribes who live in the south, Yehuda and Binyamin. There's also the tribe of Levi, the priestly sect. But the 10 tribes who are in the north, they are steeped in paganism a lot more than the Jews in the south. Along comes a king called Sancheirev. I don't know if they're in English if it's Sargon or whatever the name is. Maybe it is. And what he does is he takes these 10 tribes, and he has this idea, you know, when you conquer a land, all of the world's conquerors have faced this problem. So you conquer tremendous swaths of land. Then after a while, you can't control it. So eventually people gain their independence, such as from Canada, from the British Empire, United States, India, and on and on. I mean, throughout the history of the world. And he figured, as long as people are in their land, this is my land, and I want my independence. The Scottish, without firing a single bullet, after 650 years, acquired their independence, I don't know, about 10 years ago, which is a remarkable thing about how this gets passed down from generation to generation. We are not British. We are Scottish. And we should not be subject to the rule of Her Majesty the Queen, and so on. So what he did is he would take peoples and ship them off somewhere else. As we know, just look at this continent, full of immigrants. People lose their identity. One of the remarkable things that happens with prisoners of war sometimes is when they live among their captors long enough and they become endeared to them and then to the captives, they no longer have to keep them imprisoned. They no longer want to go back home. They just become, which is a remarkable thing when you think about it, especially in volunteer armies such as the United States or this country, where people volunteer just to stick up for their country. They're going to put their life on the line. So this Sancheirev, he took the 10 tribes and he shipped them all over the place. Until this day, we don't know where they are for sure. It's very interesting today with the internet, there's all sorts of speculation, because you see certain practices, let's say in the Far East of different peoples, which, where does it come from? Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of an expression, the big kahuna? Mm-hmm. Now, The word kahuna is a Hebrew word. Yeah. Kohen. That's right. Kahuna means priesthood. That's exactly what it means. I mean, how did that get to Hawaii or wherever and so on? You know, questions like that. How come the Jews of Bukhara, in the Bukharan language, are called Naphtali? They're not called Jews, Hebrews. They're called Naphtali. Naphtali is one of the 10 tribes. So, today, with so many years past, you can only speculate, but it's interesting.
Yeah. Ethiopia, another...
Well, Ethiopia is, they are, I think the speculation is that they're from the tribe of Dan, I believe. How people come to that conclusion, I don't know. But the thing about the Ethiopian Jews, I don't want to get off topic. I'm going to leave that right there.
They said it was a planned change to God's approach to the Jews.
I'm coming there.
In Egypt?
In Egypt. And I'm coming to it. And I'm going now first talking about the word Jews in English. And I'm working my way backwards to that point. Okay? So, why did we go to this point? The remaining Hebrews were primarily from the tribe of Yehuda, who always was the largest, the most populated tribe. Binyamin, which was one of the smallest, and the tribe of Levi, which was also one of the smallest. The remaining people became referred to as Yehuda, Yehudim, because they're essentially from Yehuda. Even in the Bible itself, in the story of Esther, which is the last book of the Tanakh, the Jews are referred to HaYehudim, Yehudim, the Jews. Why? Because most of them are from the tribe of Yehuda. In English, the letter J, which in other European languages is Ya, is in English J. So many words that are ancient words that are spelled J in other languages are spelled the same way in English, and we start saying, instead of Yaakov, we say Jacob, right? It's really Jacob, or Yaakov was spelled with a J. And same with Joseph is Yosef. And Jews, or Judea, Judea is from Judea, like Yehuda. So from there you get the contraction Judea, Jew. So even though we're using Jews, even in relationship to the Jews in Egypt, but that's not technically correct.
They weren't
Jews. They were not the tribe of Judah. They were all of the tribes. So they were technically Hebrews. What are Hebrews? They were Israelites. That's more accurate. Israelites meaning descendants of Yisrael, which is the name given to Yaakov. Mm-hmm. And going back even further, Avram was called Avram HaIvri, the Ivri, which in English, instead of saying Ivri, say Hebrew. But in Russian, for example, even today, Jews are called Yevrei. Right? What does that word mean? Ivri means from the other side. All of the world was into paganism. He's on the other side. He's into monotheism. And that's how he was known. He's the guy. He's the big promoter of the other. He's on the other side. And spiritually, of course, that's who he was. And his descendants also on the other side. So that's what Hebrew means. Hebrew means from the other side, but Hebrew goes back to Abraham. Israelites starts with the 12 tribes. And the word Jews technically starts way back later, before the destruction of the first temple. Okay. Now that we've got come across that.
Moses was
An Israelite. Even though I'm using Jews because that's become the vernacular,
yeah,
it's technically incorrect.
The catch term.
Yeah.
That's
so
right.
I can now put into
the right?
Okay.
So now, God makes a planned change to his relationship to the Jews, to the Israelites. And here is what it is. Avram elected God, so to speak. He chose to acknowledge God and to serve God. And his descendants, as long as they followed that path, they were from the same clan. With the 12 tribes, when they started having children in Egypt, and God began the servitude, God made a decision as follows. A planned decision, because it's also foretold in the binding with the covenant that he gave to Abraham. And that is, not only is he going to consider as his people those who choose to serve him, in other words, a soul connection, but he will now choose the bodies, the descendants of Jacob, to be his people. What does that mean? Because until Yaakov had children, if a person opted out, Esav opted out, he was out. Yishmael opted out, he was out. But now, if you have people who will slacken in their adherence, they still remain God's people and part of the promise that they will not disappear. Which means that now this is the first time where the Jewish people are called by God his children. Because a child, no matter how much he rebels, you don't reject him. And that's where it begins here. Where do we see this? We see this in the very story of the Exodus that I just mentioned, that I just told, that even those who opted not to struggle for spirituality, so the struggle was visited upon them with the slavery in Egypt, and they were reminded that they are not Egyptians. They are a different people. What was the time now?
6:07.
Okay. They were reminded, but nevertheless, God is not just doing away from them. Unless a person really opts, because the freedom of choice is there, that he's going to leave the faith, he leaves the faith. Now, if it's a woman, mind you, the descendants, going to the lineage of the girls, will always be part of the Jewish people.
Well, not everyone left Egypt.
Not everybody left Egypt.
Jewish people, was called, you know, the Israelites.
Not all
the
Israelites.
Okay.
Left Egypt.
There were those, actually. Hang on. Okay.
And then, yeah, there is, one minute. Israelites visited Egypt.
Okay, but I just want to be careful here, because...
Yeah.
You know what? Let me leave this, because it's going to take me off on a tangent.
I just want to remember the thought or the question for next time.
You know what? Let me just say this now. Those who are not worthy of leaving Egypt, during the plague of darkness, they died. Okay? And that's alluded to in the text of the Chumash itself. So I wasn't going to go into that because it's not so critical. But what I am saying now is this idea, which of course has kept us around throughout Jewish history, that God made a promise that we will not disappear, that begins at this point where God says, I'm choosing the bodies of the Jewish people to exist, not just people who will elect to serve me, which was with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but now the bodies of the Jewish people. So this is where the Exodus becomes very important, because that's where God makes the point explicitly, my firstborn son, Israel, let my people go. And he takes them out. Now, in the last few minutes, I hope to finish this point, because there is a major, major point coming up next time with the giving of the Torah and its relevance to today, which is unbelievable when we get there. But it is this. Every day in our prayers, we are supposed to mention and remind ourselves of the Exodus of Egypt. Now, the Exodus is very important for some of the foundational points that I've already mentioned. But there's some other things as well. Very often God says that you've got to do this and this and this because I took you out of Egypt. I am God who took you out of Egypt. What is the point? On the surface, the point is as follows. If I wouldn't have taken you out of Egypt, you'd still be slaves there. So therefore, the fact that you can even be independent and do anything is thanks to me. Therefore, you've got to do my bidding. Which is fine. But what is a deeper meaning behind that? A deeper meaning is that's really, really reflective of a person's station in the world. Why is it that you were born? Why is it that we were created? We were created for a purpose, for a destiny. So that we should bring spirituality into this material world. Without it, we have no purpose. And that's really behind this idea. I took you out of Egypt so that you should worship me. In other words, the whole reason that you even exist, this is what it's for. Except with one additional point, that I took you out of Egypt and made you into a people. This people who has this promise that you will never disappear. Why do you have this promise that you're never going to disappear as a people? In order to serve me. So that's why the Exodus of Egypt becomes so important. Now, of course, with the Exodus of Egypt, there are countless other lessons. I mean, we just go through the Haggadah and be here all night, naturally, which we're not going to go to. But this is the main point, that beginning as a people, this is where it starts. Now, I want you to remember that the plagues occurred in full view of the public. and the splitting of the Red Sea occurred in full view of the public, as did the giving of the Torah. We're going to take off from this point next time, because there is an important question that must be answered. Every religion claims to have the true purpose for living. It's true that we're the only religion that doesn't try to get people, proselytize people into our way. Oh yeah. But nevertheless, we still believe that this is our way. We don't believe that JC is the Messiah at all. So the question could be asked, is there any evidence that the Torah was actually given? Is there any evidence that this is the prescription for life that the Almighty said is the prescription? I mean, don't all religions have the same claim? And what we're going to do next time is we're going to use only pure logic, no faith. We're going to make the assumption that we are non-believers, and we'll be able to prove that the Torah that is given to us must have come from the Almighty. There is no other possible explanation. Not only that, I'll just say this. When we open the Ark, before we open the Ark, we make a statement in our Siddur, in the new edition, it's on page 222. We say this biblical quote, Ato hore saladas, you have shown us so that it should be known, Hashem Elokim, that the God is the God of the world. God showed us in a way that we cannot refute it. All right? And that, of course, is foundational to how we got here. So we're going to talk about that next time.
Okay, now we're going to talk about schedule.